This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 414 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we are talking turntables and how we can get the best sound possible with John Stratton, turntable designer for Pure Fidelity, a Canadian turntable manufacturer who make what they call heirloom quality turntables. Now, they're absolutely gorgeous. I've seen and heard many high-end turntables in my days, and Pure Fidelity turntables are amongst the most elegant. They're not cheap, though, but they're not completely outlandish. I'm aware of turntables going for far, far more, and I suppose that if I did have a fair amount of disposable income, I reckon Pure Fidelity is well worth considering. But today, we talk to John not only about high-end turntables, but also what those of us on considerably limited budgets can do to make the most out of our own existing sound systems. Oh, and by the way, if you'd like to contribute to my high-end turntable fund, please consider becoming a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. I've even got an extended interview with John up there, more questions, more turntable talk, more high-end audio blitherblather, and it's not only extended and longer than this version, but it's also commercial-free and high-resolution, so your audiophile earholes will appreciate it. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support our podcast and get all those extras. So with that, let's get into our conversation with John Stratton and all about turntables. Well, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we have with us from Pure Fidelity, Mr. John Stratton. We're going to pepper him with a lot of record nerd and turntable questions this week. How are you, John? you got your coffee or tea ready for us?
I do. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. John, you're kind of the Stradivarius of turntables, and so very happy to have you here on the show. Before we get into it, and I know you've got Pure Fidelity, and the turntables that you make are incredible. I think the term is heirloom quality turntables.
Yes, that was sort of a goal of mine. Is, I mean, there's lots of great turntables out there, but I kind of always felt they were not science, but they kind of look, everything's black and glossy and shiny, and I just wanted our tables to really look like elegant kind of pieces of furniture, and of course, but the first and foremost was to make them sound good. I remember being at a trade show. I think it was the first trade show I did in Exponent, which is a big show in Chicago every year, and I remember this gal come into the room, and it may have been a girlfriend or a wife, I'm not really sure. And I remember saying to her partner at the time, she goes, "Oh God, I don't mind that in my living room. I don't have to hide that one." So that was kind of got a chuckle out of that. But that's generally is the response we get from them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So before we talk about Pure Fidelity, because I definitely want to get into that, a lot of us will never be able to afford a level of turntable like Pure Fidelity, $10,000 or, you know, whatever that is, it translates to, you know, in other currencies. So hopefully we can also talk about kind of what the rest of us can kind of do with our current systems to make them sound better as well. So if it's all right, can you talk a little bit about your background in turntables and records?
Sure. I've come from a manufacturing background, but to tell you the truth, my manufacturing background in the past, my brother and I owned a clothing company, so we manufactured turntables, clothing. So I really have no engineering experience. A lot of my stuff was just trial and error, and sort of I really trusted my ear, which is, I think, very important when you're designing a turntable, because they're never going to measure as well as, say, a CD player or any kind of digital player. Like, that's just not what it's all about. So ours are a really simple design. If I had to describe my turntable sort of in a nutshell, I would say, think of a Rega turntable, which of course everybody knows, but think about doing that same concept with better materials, tighter tolerances, better, you know, just taking that concept of a simple, you know, simple motor, belt-driven power supply. And really, that's all it is. It's, we haven't really reinvented the wheel. We've just, quite frankly, kind of done it better than a lot of guys out there. You know, it's not like somebody that's in the digital game and they've come up with these great ways of doing things differently, or, you know, different DACs and this and that. I mean, a turntable's job is really pretty simple. It's just turn it the correct speed, do it very stably, and not let any sort of sound get back into the system, whether that be vibrations, you know, internal, external, whatever. It's just, yeah, it really is that simple. And then of course, where you really get the differences in sound is in the tone arms and the cartridges and the power supplies, sort of the add-ons per se.
Right. So it sounds to me like you're saying materials of the components of the turntable have a huge influence on the sound, and perhaps the difference between what
absolutely a massive effect.
Right. And perhaps one of the main differences with Pure Fidelity and other turntable manufacturers, I won't name names, but you know, there's a bunch of them in the $2,000 to $5,000 range.
Yeah.
Is primarily the materials that go into Pure Fidelity.
Yes, I think that's a fair thing to say. Yes, it's the materials. Like a lot of again, I don't want to mention manufacturers' mm-hmm. names either, but a lot of them, the plinth, the actual platform that turntable's built on, it might be literally like just cheap 3/4 inch particle board or plywood or something that's just painted or has some sort of coating on it. There's a lot of things going on in that material that you've got to desperately avoid.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm not a materials engineer or anything. And so when it comes to something like a plinth, you mentioned plywood. Yours are a different type of wood. How do you discern the different types of wood that are going to be better for a turntable?
Well, that's a good question. We did a lot of sampling, a lot of different materials. We started off with our the core of all our turntables, whether it's our entry level or our higher end tables, it's 2-inch thick. It's a material called Ultra MDF. Now, if you're familiar with MDF, to sort of in layman's terms, MDF is like a really, really dense particle board. And then Ultra MDF is just that much denser. So for instance, ours are 1-inch thick sheets to start with, and then they're laminated together to come up with 2-inch. Well, to start off, our particle board would be, to get down to 1-inch, it's probably about 14 inches of material that's pressed down with just press. So it's, you know, when you finally get down to 1-inch, I mean, it's just ultra dense. I mean, you can machine edges on it. You can, and it's way harder than most hardwoods. So it's an incredible material. And then we, like in our different finishes, like our quilted maple or our rosewood or whatever the veneer, then we veneer on top of it. Mm-hmm. People often ask me, well, why wouldn't you just do solid wood? And the answer is really quite simple, because solid wood, even when the tree's been cut down and machined and stuff, it's still kind of a living, breathing thing. And even with a top coat and a finish on it, that could still shrink, say, a 16th of an inch or a 32nd of an inch or something. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when everything's done with such tight tolerances, that would be an absolute disaster. So we use MDF for the stability as well.
So I've seen a couple of turntables that are made of stone, have a plinth made of stone. How would condensed MDF and stone compare?
Well, that's actually a very good question. And really dense material is very good for some things, but we found if you make the overall table too dead, it's kind of dead. Like it's just like the sound may be really accurate and very detailed and stuff, but it just doesn't have that life that live music has and stuff. And that's really, I mean, we call our tables hybrid. It's kind of a loose term, and it needs some explanation, I guess, because it's hybrid in the sense of the weight it is. So our plinth when finished is about 14 inches by 17 inches. And those weigh almost 20 pounds, this little this little chunk of MDF and veneer and stuff. Now, some British manufacturers and lots of other manufacturers, they have a little plinth that might weigh 3 pounds or something. Then you get the other extreme where guys are 80, 100 pounds sometimes, these things. And I just found that those designs, although very accurate, they just didn't have the soul, the life of music that you, that, and if you lose that, there's really no way of bringing it back. You know, your cartridge, I mean, you, with cartridge selections and different things, I mean, you can kind of get it back, but, you know, I don't know. It's been a lot of trial and error, and that's sort of where we ended up with this core.
With the plinth and the condensed MDF, I guess yes. What I'm taking away from that, and correct me if I'm reading this wrong, is you need some sort of resonance. You still need some of the rock is almost too solid. You still need some sort of resonance within the plinth to be able to translate those vibrations to, I guess, an enjoyable level, or bring out the frequencies that I guess the human ear tends to hold pleasurable more than others.
I would almost agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. The let me rephrase that.
Dogs too.
Yeah. The downsides of something being too dense and too heavy, what you said is very accurate. But what I'm hesitant to say is to say the resonance of ours, because we're basically trying to eliminate it. But obviously with that core, we haven't and totally eliminated it, because that is definitely a part of what you're hearing. But it's just dangerous for me to say, you know, our MDF resonates in the right amount. You know what I mean? Like it's sort of a funny admission almost.
Is each plinth then, each turntable then sounds maybe slightly different, because, you know, no two woods would necessarily be the same. Yeah.
No, I don't. I think ours generally do sound identical, because the MDF is such a big part of it. Whether we do it in our, we do also a couple of high gloss finishes as well. We do a high gloss white and a piano black as well. And I really don't hear any difference between the wood veneers and our painted finishes. So I really do think it's the core that really is the critical piece here.
Mm. Okay. So switching away from pure fidelity for a bit, again, most of us, you know, have significantly cheaper turntables.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about ways that, I guess the unwashed masses can improve their sound quality of their turntables? What are some common mistakes people make, and what are some remedies for those?
Well, I think the probably the most common mistake is the surface it's sitting on has a huge effect of vinyl playback. I mean, I'm going to exaggerate the point by saying, you know, if you stuck any turntable on top of a speaker, and that's the stand was, I mean, you can imagine the sound where you've got all that vibration coming. So, you know, I'm giving that as an example to sort of really exaggerate the point, but it's really important that no matter what level your table is at, it's you really, really need to try to isolate it from vibration. And if somebody has just got it sitting on a sideboard or something like that, they should at least either look at getting better feet under it, or even maybe a separate platform, because it's not a sexy purchase to buy some fancy platform or fancy stand, but it really does make a significant difference.
Oh, that makes sense. So placement with the speakers, and if you've got desktop speakers, you don't want them on the same surface as the turntable.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, sometimes you just can't avoid it.
Right.
So if you can't avoid it, then you've got to do whatever you can to isolate as much as you can from the vibrations, because there will be vibrations coming from the speakers, even if it's a little tiny desktop monitors, there's still vibration that's happening there.
Right.
I mean, you know, just to look at our line for a second, but we have two line. We have what we call the E series and the H series. And quite frankly, the main difference between them is a built-in isolation platform that goes right on the bottom of the table. So it's built right in. I mean, that's essentially the difference between the models. So that's how important it is.
Right. And how does that material in the isolation platform differ from, say, the plinth?
Well, on that model, so imagine that the plinth has 3 feet on the bottom of the plinth, and those fit inside some CNC'd out holes. So there's basically like pockets that those feet sit inside. And then on the bottom of the platform, we use these feet made for us by Isoacoustics called Gaias. So even though you're looking at it, it looks like it's all part of the table, it's actually, there's actually several layers of isolation. So you've got the feet, one level of isolation sitting in the aluminum platform, which is another level of isolation. And then and that platform is now sitting on another set of feet. So it's we put a lot of emphasis on that.
How about the turntable mat? I know there's been discussion around cork or rubber.
Yeah. I honestly, my advice there is trust your ears. Don't use something that some guy on some forum said that it changed his world for him. We don't even use mats on our tables. Our platters are made out of a material called Delrin, which is a thermoplastic actually made by DuPont. It's a very, very high-end material. And so we don't even use mats. Now, if your platter is aluminum or glass or composite or something, then you most likely need mats. But I really don't think there's a material that I would say is the best material. The felt seems to be kind of the default thing for both. And you know, I think felt generally does an okay job. My biggest beef with felt is how staticky it gets. That definitely translates to the vinyl when it's playing. I know a lot of people swear by cork, you know, some like rubber, others say, oh no, rubber deadens. I mean, there really isn't one material that works for all.
I always saw the mats as not only just, you know, part of the sound translation, part of the vibration translation, but also protects the backside of the record while it's on this platter.
No, 100%. It does for sure.
Yeah. So you say you don't use mats. You use, I think it's Delrin.
Yeah. Ours just sits right on the platter, which, you know, a lot of companies do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I have customers that still choose to use a mat even on top of our Delrin. I honestly say, I really don't think there's a definitive right and wrong. It's very system dependent. And, you know, I'm sure you'd like me to, or your listeners would like me to say, oh no, you know, product A is the absolute best thing for mat, but I don't believe that. I think they all have their plus and minuses. And I think a lot of people in this hobby industry, whatever you want to call it, they want somebody to just definitively say this is the best or this or avoid this. But I really do believe you should, you know, one of the best things I think happen is people do get more and more in the hobby is they finally start trusting their own ears. And that's really important.
Well, we're certainly looking for guidance and wisdom. So
no, I get that, but I'm just saying I don't feel there is a right material for everything.
Okay. Another question would be about record weights and how they make a difference. Now, I noticed that you are on the pro record weight side because I think every Pure Fidelity turntable does come with a weight.
Yes.
For those of us with non-Pure Fidelity turntables, how much difference does a record weight make to the listening experience?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
Another question would be about record weights and how they make a difference. Now, I noticed that you are on the pro record weight side, because I think every Pure Fidelity turntable does come with a weight.
Yes.
For those of us with non-Pure Fidelity turntables, how much difference does a record weight make to the listening experience?
Ooh, that's a loaded question as well. In our particular turntable, I would say they make quite a bit of difference. No, I know some lighter tables, Rega, for instance, which makes some great sounding tables. They strongly suggest not using weights. So, again, I don't think there's necessarily a right and a wrong. The reason I like them is our weights are made out of stainless steel. We have different models, and they're quite heavy. They will help a lot with slightly warped records. But the main reason for us, because we don't use a mat, we like the weight to make sure that the record isn't going to slip, but go anywhere at all. So that's the reason we like to. And why we supply a weight with our table, because you put the record on, put the weight on, and it's not going to move anywhere. So kind of comes back to that, you know, the possible damage you could get if a record's slipping on a hard surface and it's not, and there's no mat. So it's the two things are kind of connected there.
Now, I've also noticed the record weights that you supply have ball bearings in the bottom. So they actually can move. They're not solid bases like most record weights I've seen. What's the benefit
Correct.
Of that?
Well, the benefit of that is so you still have the weight of the thing, and ours weigh, you know, over a pound. And so the advantage of the little ball bearings is there's 12 ball bearings, I believe, in the bottom of our weights. And so really, even though it's a couple inches wide, you have the weight of the thing on the record, but really it's sitting on 12 tiny, tiny, tiny little points. So it's not really like just sitting there flat on the record. So you have the advantage what the weight does, but it's not gripping it like in one big area, if that makes sense. That's hard to describe.
Yeah. It distributes the grip points.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how does that impact? I know it's more of a cosmetic thing, but how does that impact, say, the labels on the record? Is it a possibility it makes marks or anything on those?
No, it has zero impact on that. There's no, like what you said is very accurate. It sort of spreads out the points on it, because there is those people out there that think the non-record weight believers out there think you don't want to stick this heavy weight just plunk on the middle. They feel it deadens the sound, and we don't necessarily agree with that, but the little ball bearings give the advantage of all the weight without it being a solid presence.
One of the reasons that I've hesitated to use record weights in the past is,
yep,
I had the feeling, again, based on nothing but intuition here, that it was causing stress on the belts. How would you respond to that?
Well, I can only relate to how it would be in our system, because we use belts as well. I can't really comment on what it would do on your table, but I would imagine it would be the same thing. You got to understand, when the pulley is going around, the subplatter that's being spun by the belts, or in your case, it may be actually spinning your actual platter. I'm not sure which. Either way, I think it would be the same answer anyhow. Really, once the belt's going, I really don't think that additional weight would have any extra stress on the belts. And of course, the real concern would be whether it's having any extra weight. Is it having putting any extra stress on the motors? And I just don't believe any of them are heavy enough to do that.
I know Pure Fidelity, you use two belts, not just one. I've got a question regarding, you know, direct drive, idler wheel, and belt. Obviously, it sounds like you prefer belt, but you've got two belts. What's the advantage of having that second belt?
Well, for us, we just found we got more consistent speed with one belt. We would get slight, and I really emphasize the word slight variations in sound, because we tried three belts and we found actually that we didn't like the sound of three belts, so we sort of ended up with two again by trial and error. I mean, initially when we were developing, we did single belt, we did double belts, we did triple belts, we did, you know, belts at different size. I mean, we did a lot of experimenting, flat belts, round belts, and we just we ended up with two belts. We just found it gave the most consistent speed, mm-hmm. sound. The consistent speed, which of course gives you the sound, because I think one of the things people don't understand is the speed of a turntable. If something's turning at, say, 33.7 or 33.6, but if it's rock solid stable, unless you're a trained musician, I don't think any of us would ever pick up the fact that that might be running a little bit fast. What your ear does pick up is the fluctuations, and that's when something's turning and it's 33.3, 33.4, 33.5, back to 33.2. You know, like if it's constantly changing, that's when you're going to hear that. Not so much what the speed is. Does that make sense?
It does. Look, we're built for hunting and for, you know, being very hyper alert to our environment. And so if there's a change, an alteration in, you know, light or sound or smell or anything like that, humans were kind of designed to pick that up. So I hear what you say on that, but I would think, and again, you know, let me know if I need to look at it a different way, direct drive or even idler wheel would potentially be more accurate in that space, just the way it's machined and designed. Is that incorrect?
No, and that's not incorrect. I think direct drive definitely has the ability to be as accurate or more accurate even possibly. But like I said, I really don't think your ears will ever pick up the speed, the actual speed. Now, I said 33.7, and I kind of said that to emphasize my point. If it was running that much faster, you probably would pick it up. What I really meant to say is that the speed, accuracy, and the maintaining of the speed, whether it's 33.37 or whatever, but it's always bang on that speed, you will not hear a difference. Problem with idler drives is there's just a lot of mechanical stuff going on there, you know, with the wheels and the gears and this and that. And as much as I know, there's people that won't listen to anything but idler drives. to me, I couldn't live with the inherent noise that they make, as subtle as it may be. By the time, if you've got a good cartridge moving coil and you're multiplying that signal by 8,000 times or 10,000 times, you're going to pick up that rumble. It's just the way it is.
Right. And with idler wheel and direct drive, are there also more points of failure just because it is?
Oh, absolutely. There's just a ton going on. Absolutely. There's a lot going on.
Hmm. Okay. You've chosen to use a couple of belts, and you mentioned moving coil. So
yeah.
Let me know about your thoughts, you know, moving magnet opposed to moving coil.
Well, I think moving coil to me is sort of the ultimate when you get into cartridges and the detail pickup and stuff. Now, that's not to say you can still get some extremely, extremely good moving magnet cartridges. So they are not inherently inferior. Like a really good, I know of really good moving magnet cartridges that still may cost $3,000 or $4,000. And that's, you know, very, very expensive. So they're not just inherently inferior to moving coils, but they're just, there's something about moving coils that just, to me, has that right sound, has that real live sound that I think moving magnets struggle to mimic.
Kind of moving around the turntable here.
Yeah.
What do we need to know about tone arms? Again, the vast majority of us are, you know, we kind of take what we get with our turntable. But I've seen tone arms go tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and no, you can. And I mean, I would be lying if I didn't say when you start getting into some serious coin, your incremental improvements definitely start to slow down. And you start, I mean, there's people out there that will pay $4,000 or $5,000 more than what their present tone arm gives them to get a little bit more resolution. Now, that's not how I operate, and that's not how majority of audiophiles operate, or music lovers, I should say, operate. But for those that don't have money restraints, or many, you know, they buy what their ears tell them to buy. I can't really comment on other brands, but the brand that we're very high on is a brand called Origin Live out of the UK, and it's owned by a man named Mark Baker. They started off by modifying Regas, actually, but they now make their own tone arms, and they make tone arms from about $800 right up to, you know, $15,000 and $20,000. And as they go up the line, each one does get a little better than the next, but, you know,
where does it end?
There's going to be people listening to this and thinking, this guy's on crack. This guy's just, I can't afford that. And I feel for that. I'm not saying at all that you need to spend a bunch of money to get good enjoyment out of an analog rig, because you don't.
Right.
But as you go up the food chain, I would say what you get is more resolution and more the feeling of live music. It starts to mimic live music more, where you're sitting, let's say you're listening to an old Blue Note recording or something, and you're sitting there and you literally, I know it's a cliche, but you're literally sitting there and you feel like these guys are playing right in front of you. That's what I believe you get with really good analog.
And right.
Entry level still gives you a great experience, but, you know, there's just a little bit more of what we're all attracted to in analog.
Sure.
As you go up the food chain. I'm sorry. So the one area that I wanted to go back and touch on when you talked about what are areas they can improve, mm-hmm. and stuff. Now, people that have a lot of money invested in their analog rigs, whether it be their table, cartridges, phonostage, whatever, probably without failure, they all have really good record cleaning machines. So that's the other thing I would really strongly recommend to people, is keep your vinyl as clean as you can. Now, you don't have to go out and spend that multiple thousands on a good record cleaning machine. There's a lot of the manual ones that are $100, $150 and stuff is still going to do a good job. But it's really important, as you know, to keep your records as clean as you can.
Pivoting back to tone arms.
Yeah.
You employ a straight tone arm. There's some S-shaped tone arms.
Yeah.
What do you think are the pros or the cons of either or?
Well, I know the majority of the Japanese tone arms out there, they use an S-shaped. And I'll be honest, I don't know the science behind the theory. Knowing that, you know, essentially the wiring to the cartridge leads, whether it's going through a straight tube or curved tube, I certainly have, there'd be no difference as far as I'm concerned on that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's a resonance thing they claim or not. I honestly don't know the science behind the difference, you know, why people say one is better over the other. I don't even know if those that make an S shape, I don't even know if they claim it's better than a straight arm. There may be other reasons they do straight arm. I'm kind of embarrassed to say I don't know.
That's okay. You got your hands full with everything else. But how about the length of the tone arm? You know, does the size matter? Does the length matter?
Well, that's a really interesting topic, because the 9-inch or 9.5-inch, which is the majority of the arms out there, is sort of the chosen length. And that's we certainly use that length as well. And the theory behind, well, I shouldn't say the theory. The longer the tone arm, the better it will track when it comes to the inner grooves. Now, that's just a scientific fact. Mm. But a good tone arm tracks so well anyhow that I think that's kind of a moot point when it comes to good tone arms. And there's no question that a 9-inch, a 9.5-inch, whatever you want to call it, is a more lively sounding. The longer tone arms do tend to have a little bit softer sound. There's a noticeable, what would I say? It's not actually the speed, but it does have a little bit of a softer sound. I mean, Origin Live, if you go to their site, they have a whole paper on just pointing out the differences between the 9.5 and the 12-inch arms. We have chosen not to do a 12-inch because we just feel the 9.5-inch is sort of the perfect compromise. There's that word I don't like to use. But at some point, to be honest, we may do an arm with a 12-inch. And it's not that I feel it's better, but there is definitely some audiophiles out there that insist on 12-inch. And as soon as they find out that we don't offer 12-inch, they move on to a different brand. And we're aware of that. But I feel if we ever did add a 12-inch, it wouldn't necessarily be a big sonic improvement. I think it'll just be different.
So with my turntables, I noticed a big difference, and maybe this is another tip for people who are, you know, how to improve their sound of their existing system. Once I got good at setting up my turntable,
yeah,
there was a huge improvement. And again, just kind of making sure the stylus is at the right level inside the record grooves and tracking from the first groove to the end as best as possible. Once I started dialing in that, the sound improved. I mean, it was noticeable immediately, hugely.
Yes.
I'm thinking a lot of people may not do that. They probably don't. Yeah,
which is surprising to me, but because I absolutely 100% agree with you that the setup, it is important to take your time and get set up properly, especially the tracking weight, because manufacturers will have a recommended tracking weight, and it's nothing to do with maintaining their cartridge for, you know, it's setting up the weight is going to affect how the cantilever sits. If you have it too heavy, it's going to sort of squash the cantilever. That's going to change the vertical tracking angle. There's a lot of stuff that goes on, and it's really important that people do follow the recommended tracking weight. And also, you know, lining up the cartridge using a protractor and stuff, it's really important to take your time and get it done right, because it will make a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have something really set right at the right spot, you may be picking up all the information in the left channel, the left part of the groove, and you might be only getting half of the right groove, or, you know, and so you're hearing the sound out of both speakers, and you're thinking, oh, it's all good, but you don't even know you don't have it dialed in.
Another part of the chain are the cables and the electricity.
Yeah.
I purchased a receiver not too long ago, and the guy at the audio shop said, here, use this power cable because it provides cleaner power to, you know, from the wall to your receiver. And it's this big hunking thing that was $200. And of course there's, you can go crazy with cables and pricing.
Absolutely.
What's your position on cabling and electricity and the non-turntable parts of that impact the audio chain?
Yeah, well, cabling is a 4-month long conversation if you really get into it. Yeah. My feeling on cables, it's a tricky one because I honestly feel cables are just tone controls, and you can affect the sound a lot by changing cables. And I think where people really can get into trouble is they'll buy a cable that's been highly regarded, and let's say Brand X. And what they don't necessarily know is Brand X might emphasize the highs and the mids and be really detailed. And if they've got an all digital system that lets, for instance, it's already giving you that edge, and you've got a solid state amplifier that's already giving you that edge. If you stick these cables in, all of a sudden you're going to have an assault on your ears. You're going, oh my God, there's just too much detail, too much. It's too bright. And on the same time, somebody that has maybe a tube amplifier and something that the sound is sort of soft and he feels it needs a little bit more dynamic, that exact same cable that was horrible in one person's system might completely be the answer for the guy that feels his system is kind of lacking. And I think it's one of the most difficult things for consumers to get right if they're just buying stuff based on reviews. Because all cable guys they'll all advertise their stuff as, oh, our cables are so neutral, you'll just hear what's ever in the recording, and it's this and it's that, and it's a bunch of bullshit. It's cables definitely emphasize one frequency over the other. So I feel sorry for people, and I've done it numerous times myself where I bought cables that I thought would be the answer, and I get them home and they're dreadful. So I think that's one area where a dealer is hugely, hugely important, because then you go into a dealer and you tell them what you think your system is lacking, or maybe it's not lacking, but maybe it's, oh, my system sounds too bright, it's too detailed, I need something to tame, you know, and they will hopefully steer you in the right direction. Because cables are, I think, very, very difficult to buy, to sort of sight unseen and match them up with your equipment, because you just can't explain synergy sometimes. You know, no, there's just...
Like, is there anything we should be looking for in terms of cables? Any questions to ask, you know, when at a dealer?
Well, again, to me, it's if somebody's really happy with their system and it sounds good, I'd leave the cables alone. But if somebody thinks things are missing, or I really think I'm not getting as much bass as I should, or I know this cartridge or this arm is capable of more bass, but I'm not hearing in it, you know, then you can go to them and say, do you have any cables that are known for a little bit bottom end and stuff? And hopefully it'll be the right choice. But it is a real crapshoot. It is, even for me, and I've been doing this for 40 odd years, and I've many times got cables wrong where I've heard them thinking this would be great, and I get them home and I go, oh.
But records themselves are a crapshoot. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Unless you're doing UHQR and you got a, you know, you've got real clear provenance on the pressings or the, you know, most times people pick up a record, they don't know if it's the first or the 500th that's come off the stamper.
No, for sure.
It's hard to kind of zero in on what the potential of the record can be that you're missing.
Yeah, no, records are, that's the frustration of this hobby at times too, is you're buying vinyl and you go, oh, this, I'm not saying sound sucks, but you, you know, when you have a really, really exceptional pressing of exceptional music, it's just so magical. And reissues especially are so, there's certain labels that I think are really close to slam dunks, where they generally are always good pressing, but there's a lot out there where you just, you know, you just don't know what you're going to get, and they're friggin' expensive.
Yeah. Trial and error constantly. Yeah. Is there a record that you test with? What are some records that you keep pulling out in terms of the high watermark of your collection? And of course, as you're working on turntables, ones that you use to define quality.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. I mean, and it's not necessarily that they're the ultimate recordings, but it's maybe just songs I know so well. And there's certain points in the music where, let's say, an upright bass kicks in or a set, you know, there's just certain recordings that you just know so well that I use as testers. And quite frankly, they're not always audiophile records either. I mean, like, for instance, Michael Frank's Art of the Tea, which I've had since probably 74 or 75 when I bought new, it's still one of my favorite records. And it's extremely well recorded. Speaker's Corner, I think, just did a reissue of it about a year or so ago, and I bought it, and I was very happy to hear. I mean, it was exceptionally good pressing. But you never know. I also use female vocals a lot when I'm setting up tables and testing. I think that's always a really good thing to go by.
With Pure Fidelity, you've got a price point you've got to hit, yeah, and to be able to make the business a going concern, which is understandable. If you had a less limited budget there, if that wasn't a constraint, if you were to design the perfect table, you know, budget be damned.
Yeah.
What do you think you would add to the configuration that you have with Pure Fidelity right now?
Well, that's a really good question, because honestly, as far as the table goes, and the Harmony and Horizon, which have the built-in isolation platforms, I don't really see that there's much room for improvement there. Where my improvements would be climbing up the ladder with the tone arms and with cartridge, because the table, I'm not saying it can't be improved, but I don't think it could be improved significantly. There could be a little couple of small incremental things done to it, but, you know, perhaps a little bit even thicker platter, maybe a 3-inch MDF core, and some way of further isolating the motor. Maybe even having the motor freestanding inside the sort of envelope of the plinth. I've never really thought about it fully, but my quick answer is definitely in the tone arm and the cartridges would be where immediately you could make some improvements.
Now, you've got the speed control separate.
Yeah.
But you have the motor inside the plinth. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Was there a reason why, since you already have the separate speed controls, why you wouldn't put the motor outside the plinth? Combine those two?
We could have, but it was sort of trying to follow the sort of form over function kind of thinking. Is we're trying to make this as elegant as possible, so we're hiding a lot of the guts of it, yeah. And that's very intentional. There's no advantage of having it inside, but I don't feel there's any disadvantage of having it attached either, because it is isolated, and you know, it sits on sort of a little acrylic plate, which is then separated from the MDF, and then of course the motor has a pulley, and that's so that further isolates any vibration. Then you've got the mm-hmm. the belts, which another level of isolation, then spinning a sub platter, which then sits on the platter. So if there was any tiny bit of vibration getting in, it's going through so many different areas before it would ever reach the needle that we just didn't feel it was a compromise design wise.
Right.
But it was definitely a goal to visually is to keep it separate and have it very mm-hmm. elegant looking. I mean, our tables, looking at them, look very simple, but there's a lot going on under the hood.
Oh, I think one of the things I love about Pure Fidelity turntables is they are elegant.
Yeah.
And as you say, heirloom quality, they're almost like a piece of art. And I've seen many turntables, heard many turntables that are far, far north price-wise of the Pure Fidelity. And they look like, I don't know, they look like something from an alien civilization that I'm not sure will age that well. Yeah, kind of. You know, and again, no critique to them. It just seems like, okay, that's a little bit, I'm not sure that will look great in my house. I'm sure my wife would raise her eyebrow at it. But
no, I think for sure.
Yeah, but also the engineering, things like the ruby bearing. Can you talk a little bit about that ruby bearing?
Yeah, so that's a perfect example how we can use the materials that we feel are best for an application without sort of having price constraints. So, I mean, we're making hundreds of tables a year, not thousands or multi-thousands. So like a ruby bearing it probably cost, I said on the website that it costs 10 times what a stainless steel ball is, but in actual fact, it's probably about 50 times what a ruby or what a stainless steel ball costs. But for us, it's so hard. I mean, the only thing harder than a ruby is basically a diamond. So the harder the surface, the less friction. You know, less friction means less noise. It really is that simple. And that sort of goes back to the thing I said earlier about think about our tables as the simplicity of a Rega, but with really good material choices and tight tolerances and stuff. And, you know, you think of, again, think of Rega or any other brand that's building thousands and thousands of tables a year. So if this ruby ball is costing, it's about $50 more than a stainless steel ball. But for me, so for $50 more on my table, it's going to sound a lot better than a steel ball. Why wouldn't I make that decision? Whereas somebody like a British manufacturer that is doing thousands of tables, if you're paying $50 more on the ball that will do the same job, it still sits on the bottom of the bearing well and the subplatter sits on top of that ball. If you're doing, say, 10,000 tables a year or 20,000 tables a year and you're spending $50 more on a part, that gets into some serious money. So I can understand why they wouldn't use ruby balls. But right. for us, because we don't really have any economies of scale in our manufacturing. We're a boutique manufacturer and you know, we're building in small quantities. And to me, it's I would never even consider using something that I knew was inferior to save $40. I just wouldn't do it.
So to answer the question we asked earlier, you know, improvements or changes you would make, budget be damned, maybe a diamond bearing. That would be the next step for
Yeah.
All right. So, John, we look forward to hearing about that diamond turntable one day. thanks again for coming on the show. For folks who are interested in learning more about Pure Fidelity, purefidelity.ca. They're beautiful turntables. I mean, they're absolutely gorgeous. You know, as I said, it's heirloom quality. It's kind of the final upgrade. John, thank you so much for joining us here. And I hope we can turn to you whenever we have some record nerd or turntable questions as our resident turntable.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
All right. Well, now we have a friend of the show that is a turntable designer. We could turn to him whenever we have questions or are in need of further information. Google up Pure Fidelity. Again, they're very gorgeous turntables. Oh, and don't forget, we've got an extended version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, and we thank you in advance for your support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them in the Facebook group, share them on the Reddit forums, share them on your Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it this week. Hell, even put it on Instagram Threads. I guess that's a thing now. And we so do appreciate it. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records or turntables, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.